Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com.
This is the Bitcoin Formula episode 2, which is actually episode number 3 if you count the pilot episode, right? And as usual, the guest in the studio here is Datavetaren. Welcome.
Thank you.
How are you today?
I'm good, thanks.
Great, great, great. So it's been a while since we did the last episode, and I'd like to do a quick recap what we were talking about in these two episodes that we've done. We talked about what is money, which is a very big subject, right?
Yeah, it's a huge subject.
Huge, actually, and it makes the world go round, so it's a pretty important subject. Then, yeah. we went into the subject, what is the blockchain, and what is a blockchain, and where does the word come from? And to understand that what we did recap, you need to listen to these episodes, but we can sort of pretty easily recap what the blockchain is, where the word comes from, which you and I together sort of did some detective work to find. You found it in the code, Satoshi's code, the word blockchain.
I think that the word blockchain is sometimes used in regular databases as well, because when you have a series of transactions, you usually chop them up into chunks. And I think there's where the word block come from. And when you order these chunks in time, you get a chain of blocks. So that's where the word blockchain comes from. But yeah, Satoshi himself did not use blockchain in his paper, but it was there in the code.
Yeah, as a comment, right?
Yeah, well, there's a class called blockchain in the code. So
it's even a class.
Okay. Yeah, it's a class called blockchain, yeah.
Okay, great. So we have that pretty well defined then. So then we also talked about central banks for a long time. And we even defined what is Bitcoin compared to the altcoins. You said Bitcoin is the longest chain with the most proof of work gone into it, right? Everything else is an altcoin.
Yeah, I think that's the best way of defining Bitcoin, because then you can also fork the Bitcoin into something else. You can change the protocol.
Yeah.
But the longest chain with the most proof of work will always define what is Bitcoin. And I think the economic incentive is that people will tend to follow the chain that is the strongest one, which is, you know, the most secure one.
Yeah.
So if there is a change in the protocol, everybody will follow the strongest chain.
Yeah. So you can say the chain with the most proof of work gone into it is also the chain with the most energy put into it over time.
Actually, that's an even better definition to say most energy, because if you change the algorithm on what proof of work is, then the current mining equipment will become worthless, and so you will get a chain that is longer according to that definition. But I think still that the most energy pumped into the chain will define Bitcoin, because it's the most secure one, right? Because all these miners out there that are using their specific hardware to secure the blockchain will, if you try to change the algorithm on what proof of work is, then all these miners will become worthless, and the chain will also become worthless because it will no longer be secure.
Yeah, you need the energy, and that also comes down to the formula that I've sort of formulated, Bitcoin formula, which is sort of energy divided by time equals security, which is truth in this area. But let's go into that a bit later. I'd like to talk in this episode about what's, because we went through sort of the last 5,000 years in our last two episodes, But we didn't really get into sort of the last 20 years and all the specifics that's been happening in the last 20 years. For instance, the BTM, which is a Bitcoin teller machine, an ATM, but we're talking about a Bitcoin teller machine. These machines cropped up or popped up a couple of years ago. And I brought a machine to Stockholm about a year ago in February. We had an event called Bitcoin Fun Fair. The event is still available online, bitcoinfunfair.com. And it's going to be another event. The guys that are planning another event are working on it right now. And I'd like to talk about how the experiences we had bringing the BTM here to Stockholm. Because we had a big event where we collected a lot of merchants together. And we helped them, we teach them more or less how to use a Bitcoin wallet, how to sell stuff for Bitcoin. And the experience or the learnings we got were more or less that they weren't ready for this. They thought it was much easier to use a regular credit card, a Visa or MasterCard, to sell their stuff. And they had these iSettle solutions, the Swedish iSettle solution, to sell their sort of flea market kind of stuff. But the BTM was very popular. We brought one BTM to this space, put it in the lobby, and we had several thousands of guests coming there, and most of them were very interested in BTM, just for their own sort of interest. They wanted to try it out, to put in fiat money into the machine, and to get some Bitcoin out. There were no real use cases for it, but people really wanted to just trade out, which was an interesting experience. But now the BTM has been placed right across from the Central Bank of Sweden in Stockholm. There's a space there called Epicenter, where a lot of sort of startups get together and they rent an office or they rent part of a table to work there. It's like a startup accelerator kind of place. And the funny thing about it is that it's situated right across from the central bank. And the guy who runs this BTM now is called Christian Ander, a Swedish guy. He started an exchange called BTCX a couple of years ago, where he helped people to exchange from fiat to Bitcoin in different ways using bank accounts. But now he uses this BTM more or less. And I did an interview with this guy just a few days ago, or maybe even a few weeks ago it was, where we talked about this. And let's listen to the interview first and then comment on, you know, the BTM business.
All right.
So here it is. This is Christian Ander from BTCX. And welcome to Christian Ander, right? That's the right pronunciation?
Yes.
Pronunciation.
Yes, that's correct.
Christian Ander. But it's a Swedish name?
It is a Swedish name, yes.
You are from Sweden?
I am.
From where?
Stockholm, Solna.
Oh, yeah. But you studied in Lund, right?
Yeah. I've been around in Sweden, both Lund, Malmö, Copenhagen,
yeah,
and Göteborg.
And why am I interviewing you? Because you have gotten into Bitcoin very early in Sweden, right? What year was it?
I found Bitcoin in a basement, 2011.
In a basement?
Yes, in Östermalm. They have a free open source nerd basement, basically, where you do everything with computers, no matter how old they are.
Yeah. And you were a nerd? Are you a nerd?
I'm still a nerd.
Yeah.
I.
What's your education?
I'm quantum physicist from Lund and Uppsala.
Okay, yeah.
That's also quite nerdy.
It's very nerdy. But I actually have a kind of stupid or maybe simple sort of comparison between the Bitcoin network and quantum physics. You know, I mean, talking about the measurement problem or the sort of the insecurity, you can't tell the state of particles with speed or position at the same time.
Yeah. Heisenberg.
Yeah. So it's more about that's very similar to the blocks of Bitcoin, because you don't know where the next block will come from or who will find it or exactly what it'll contain. It's just sort of floating up there until we sort of narrow it down and measure it. Then we get the results.
Yeah.
It's an interesting sort of, I think, comparison to the quantum physics world.
Yeah, it's statistics, basically, and probabilities.
But how did you sort of, what was it about Bitcoin that got you interested in it back then?
I was doing my research in Uppsala and was also looking into other business opportunities.
Yeah.
And I was looking into a platform for secondhand goods. And I needed to find a payment solution for it. And since secondhand can be really cheap, a card fee was not, it was too expensive.
Yeah. What year was that?
That was 2011.
Okay.
So I said to myself, basically, okay, I'm probably going to need to buy or build my own financial system. And next week I found Bitcoin in this basement.
Okay.
So I was quite...
good timing.
Yeah, I was quite happy.
So that was it. You just got into it immediately. Did you understood it immediately?
No. I mean, I still discover things about it today, 5 years later.
Yeah.
So it's really, really interesting. But yeah, I when I heard about it, it was open source, and I always loved open source. So I was like, okay, open source money. This is so cool.
Yeah.
So I downloaded the blockchain like 5 minutes after they told me, and started mining the very next day.
Yeah, you did.
Yes.
So you mined in 2011.
Yeah, but just with the CPU. Yeah. So I don't think even I had have the wallet left.
Okay. But, it's the same for me. I lost a computer from 2011 in the spring. So we just mined for fun at an office. Yeah. We didn't understand at all. But no, there was no point to it. You know.
Funny numbers and
Yeah.
Open source.
But how's it been since then? What did you start off doing, I mean, in this space?
Yeah, so it took me like a year before I actually tried to do something professional with it. The first problem I encountered was, if you're going to buy Bitcoin, how do you do that?
Yeah.
And at that time, there was Mt. Gox, who was the biggest exchange. But it took me over a week to send money there. It's in Japan. So I said, like, okay, maybe there is other people in Sweden who has the same problem. So I took a weekend and opened up BTCX.
Okay.
So it was
So BTCX was the first venture.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's still the main venture.
It is. Yeah. It is.
Yeah. And so what mechanisms are you offering there?
Basically, it's the same mechanism as 4 years ago, and that's buying Bitcoin quick.
Yeah.
And
so you transfer money from your bank account to your web page and get your Bitcoins back to your wallet or something.
Yeah. So today it's automated with Swish and or Bankgiro.
In Sweden, yeah. In Sweden, we have Swish.
In Sweden, yes.
Swish is for your international listeners. It's a sort of Swedish kind of central bank money people can send in between each other on their phones.
Yeah.
Which is pretty amazing thing. It's a pretty new thing, very modern thing from the Swedish central bank.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're allowed to use the Swish system.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now it just takes, instead of 7 days, 4 years ago, now it takes below than 3 minutes for the Swedish people to get Bitcoin.
Well, that's pretty amazing, actually.
Yeah, I mean, they're happy.
Yeah, and the central bank is helping out.
They are.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, our office is next to the Central Bank of Sweden, so they actually come over sometimes. And when they have guests from other countries, they tend to send them over to me. I mean, we work with money. They work with money.
Yes. And it's, so they send people over to talk about Bitcoin with you, or
yes,
yeah.
Bitcoin and blockchain, and our office is in Epicenter.
Sorry,
which is also about innovation. Mm. So there, I don't know.
That's in central Stockholm, right?
Yeah.
Mm. So I've also been on a meeting with Riksbanken and talked about Bitcoin. They're getting more and more interested in this area. They need to understand it, of course.
Yeah,
because it's growing so fast. Yeah. But then over the years, what other mechanisms have you been offering? Is it just the exchange you've been doing?
We've been experimenting. We had a point of sale solution 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And that was popular among like cafes and smaller restaurants to just have an option. And then we also tried other currencies, cryptocurrencies like Litecoin, Dogecoin, but they usually go in waves. Like right now, Ethereum is the hottest. So
it's the hottest, maybe compared to all the other altcoins.
But yeah.
If you compare it to Bitcoin, it's nothing at all, really. It's like really, really...
No.
It's just among the banking or fintech sort of consultant industry.
Yeah.
There's where the Ethereum is sort of happening.
Yeah. But we tend to follow the trends and what the consumer want, we deliver.
So are you delivering Ethers or...?
We are not, but we are looking into it.
Okay.
It's a bit of a, you know, technical building to get it in place.
But the proof of coffee. I need some proof of coffee. The point of sale solution, that wasn't something you wanted to go forward with. Was it because of the competition or?
We actually changed the platform 2 years ago, so we had to remove everything and rebuild it again.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have been building a new one, which we are just testing right now.
But are you only offering your service to Swedish customers or any country in the world? Or
our main platform, bt.cx, is for Europe.
Okay.
But all the other services are right now only for the Swedish market.
Yeah.
But when it's working and we try it out, we just go.
And it's only within the EU?
Yeah, and that's for because of the money laundering rules.
Yeah.
As soon as we go outside of EU, we need to adapt to other markets, and then we need to put a lot of effort in.
A lot of money.
Yeah, it's really costly to run a financial business, I noticed.
Yeah. So, but you and I have actually collaborated in one way. Actually, earlier, I bought a Bitcoin BTM to Sweden about a year ago.
And
we tried it out for a while, just like a research project for this event that I did, Bitcoin Fun Fair in Stockholm.
Yeah.
Where we had there's a company in Copenhagen.
Yes.
OpenCoin is called, right?
Yes.
And we got a BTM here last year, and we saw a lot of people testing it out, trying it out at this event. People like to use the BTM.
Yeah. I mean, we
and the BTM is an ATM, but for Bitcoin, of course. You put in your fiat, you know, bills, and you get some Bitcoin back to your phone, right?
Yeah, you convert your paper bills into cryptographically tokens.
Yeah. So the BTM is an interesting sort of concept.
Yeah.
And people liked it during the Bitcoin Fun Fair event, but then you have taken it over since then, more or less, to research that project. And how is it that? What do you see? What's the benefits of a BTM or having that in a physical location?
Yeah, I mean, I see two very clear things. I mean, it's a good marketing thing. Epicenter is a popular place, so many companies. I mean, big companies as Telia and SEB is there.
Mm.
And they see the BTM and they see Bitcoin and makes Bitcoin real.
Yeah.
And so many people just go there and buy Bitcoin for 100 kroner or 20 kroner just to like, oh, is this really working or how is it working?
Yeah.
And then it also has another usage, and it's people who have cash and they want to use Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So it's also another market that our platform is not supporting.
But it's not people for selling Bitcoin to the BTM. People are not doing that, are they?
They're
mainly getting Bitcoin from it.
It depends on how the value of Bitcoin is going.
Okay. So if the exchange rate goes up, people are selling Bitcoin in the BTM.
No, the other way. If Bitcoin is going down as it did last spring,
then
people are selling Bitcoin. Oh. And if it's going up, they are buying.
Okay.
So they're following the trend, basically.
All right.
So.
Yeah, okay. That's interesting.
Mm.
But so the machine is just standing there in a place in Stockholm, and people are just going in there and using it.
Yeah, exactly.
Hmm. Do you want to talk about your banking relationship at all?
I mean, my banking relationship. I had six different banks.
You've had?
I had them all in Sweden, basically.
Yeah.
But it's right now it's actually going better and better. They are understanding that this is an interesting innovation, so they want to be informed, or I mean they have a lot of questions.
Yes.
But a few years back they did everything they could to not like us, or I don't know, they didn't like us, so there was a big job.
They put obstacles in the way for people or businesses wanting to use Bitcoin. Many of the banks did, We have some banks in Sweden actually that are pretty positive towards Bitcoin and they are accepting Bitcoin businesses, which is very nice.
Yeah.
And it's clever to do that. It's smarter to sort of if you want to understand something, you can't just block it out. You need to sort of work with it to understand it.
Yeah.
And then you can sort of make a decision on whether it's good or bad, or if, you know, how people are going to use this. So I think the banks are coming around to that fact that they need to sort of, we can't just, you know. Do you agree with that assessment?
I totally agree. Yeah. And when I'm talking with the banks, they kind of understand that. And I also get, I make a comparison with browsing and said, like, why would you build a web page not supporting HTTP?
Yeah.
And it's like, why would you build a payment system or a transaction of any value not using the blockchain? And when I say that, they kind of, okay, yeah, yeah. And they, most banks sit with very old system, and they are, all of them are looking into rebuilding it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think at least the Swedish banks, they are going to do, all of them is going to do something with the blockchain.
Yeah.
They just don't know what.
Yeah, no, no. Well, it takes time to understand the blockchain.
It does, yes. Yeah.
But, and it's a very interesting time right now, sort of the change where, you know, the exchange rate, or the NIRP, has gone down. We have the negative interest rates.
Yeah.
And we have banks who sort of more or less want to get rid of their cash.
Yeah.
People, now, if you have money, it costs money to have money, if you think about money as cash,
yeah,
more or less.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is an interesting sort of point in time where they maybe want to move away from cash or fiat currencies.
Yeah.
And Bitcoin is here right now at the same sort of same time.
Yeah,
but they're not thinking about Bitcoin as a replacement for their own money or cash, of course.
No,
no. Is it like a complement they're thinking about Bitcoin, right?
Or good question.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I
or maybe even a competitor somehow. Or
That's a really good question. I mean, since I started with Bitcoin, I kind of been very enthusiastic about it, and like, okay, this, I want this to become our new world currency.
Yeah,
it's global, it's kind of democratic, it's no one is in charge, basically. And that is some values I would like to see in a world currency. But then you have in nations, you have different other interests, like politics and banking system, especially from Riks or central bank.
Yeah.
So what I'm looking into now is, okay, so maybe we should put the Swedish krona on the blockchain. It will have similar attributes as Bitcoin. So that's actually what we are working now and talking with the banks and payment industry.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that kind of movement is going around all over the world. I mean,
yeah,
each and every bank and government is looking into that, sort of,
yeah,
create our own Bitcoin or our own sort,
yeah,
of version of it.
In one way or another.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we'll see if that succeeds or not.
Mm.
Me personally, I'll say they won't succeed with that part, Bitcoin doesn't really work like that, I'd say. It's not, if you want to have a government controlling it, then it's centralized. And
yeah,
we already have that kind of, you know, centralized databases, like a fiat currency. It's,
yes,
the same thing.
You know, so. But you can do a combination.
Maybe. Yeah. We'll see going forward.
We will see.
Yeah, yeah. If it's possible to do a sidechain, for instance, and that sidechain can be a national currency or a sovereign currency, maybe. But it's just promises and just... Today we have one mechanism in Bitcoin, it's value transferring, that works.
Yeah.
We don't know much about anything, any other mechanism at all.
No.
Just promises, guesses, ideas.
Yeah.
Nothing has really been coming to fruition, right? Just yet.
Well, I mean, everything is a big experiment.
Yeah.
So, and there's a lot of things going on.
Yeah, and people think this will go fast. It won't go fast. It'll take years.
Mm.
It'll take 5-10 years only to get to these mechanisms, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's also what I realized when I started with this. I was like, okay, in 2 years, everyone will use this. This is so cool. I mean, I see the technology, I see the benefits and the beauty, and for me, it went quick.
Yes, that was the same thing back in 1994, 95 when the web came.
Yeah,
for us, you know, nerds, this is going to be well.
And 15 years later, we have YouTube.
15 years later, we have YouTube. That's more right. But how do you see sort of the immediate future, and then what are you going to go into doing the next, like, 1 to 2 years? Because we have a sort of a business where things are going much slower than the VC people envisioned, at least.
Mm.
So, I mean, are you just going to move forward with the exchange, with the brokerage thing you're doing, and the BTM thing, or?
Yeah, that I mean, basically the goal of our company is to connect regular fiat with cryptocurrencies. And we don't really take a stand if that's Bitcoin or Litecoin or Ethereum or whatever. It's like we're following the market. And what we're good at is doing compliance and cryptocurrency. So in that bridge is where we will always be. For instance, now we have Swish connected to blockchain in a very, very quick way. And continue.
Yeah, well, it's not connected to the blockchain, really. It's connected through you. You're an intermediate.
Yeah.
And you're sort of...
But you can do a Swish transaction. It ends up on the blockchain with the help of us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And having that mindset is what we're continuing building with. So if there is a national cryptocurrency, Swedish kronor, we will do the same with that.
Yeah, okay. So I see you want to be sort of the shit in between.
The shit. Yeah, I call it the bridge.
Yeah, the bridge.
Okay. Thank you.
So you want to sort of help everybody get their old money
into the new system.
Into the new money system.
Yeah. I usually talk about landline phones and mobile phones.
Yeah.
So you want to be able to make a phone call from the landline phone to the mobile phone.
Yeah.
And that's need to be seamless.
Okay. That's a good analogy. That one. So what else is up on the sort of horizon now? What are you doing right now?
Yeah, I'm also working with an event called Urban Burn.
All right.
Which is a Swedish copy of Burning Man.
Okay. Okay. Yeah,
which
yeah.
they will have in Stockholm in March, 11th of March.
In Stockholm, there's no desert here, right?
No, there's no desert, but they founded a deserted building.
Okay.
In Sikla.
Yeah.
And so there will be a lot of crypto people there, and also people from the makerspace,
yeah.
and artists, both like painting and music. And
cool. What date is it? Do you know that?
Yeah, 11th to 13th of March.
Of March?
March, no? Yes. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So it's yeah. pretty soon.
Yeah, in a month, basically.
Yeah, and the connection to Bitcoin is, of course, that it's sort of freedom.
Yeah, freedom, alternative, and yeah, mostly freedom. Burning Man is much about artistic freedom and doing what you want.
So are you taking part in arranging that, or?
I'm going to hold a workshop.
Okay. Yeah.
And I mean, it's an open space, so probably there will be hundreds of workshops from Internet of Things and painting and dancing and martial arts to Bitcoin and 3D printing. And
cool, great. I'll go there if I can. I'll definitely come
yeah,
there.
Yeah, I think that it's a good place to be.
I've always wanted to go to Burning Man too. I've never gone there. Have you gone there?
No. Me too.
Next year.
Okay.
This summer.
Yeah. This summer.
Okay, great. Thanks for this little session here and for the podcast.
Thank you.
If people out there, if you want to interact with Christian Ander, you can go to his Twitter account, I guess.
Yes.
And the handle is @AnderCHRIX, right?
Correct.
Ander Crix, something like
yes.
that.
Yes.
Ander Crix. Well, great. Thanks.
Thank you.
Maybe I can talk to you again soon.
Yeah, sure. You're welcome.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Okay.
So that was the interview with Christian Ander. Very interesting. And this Urban Burn event he's talking about is actually taking place this weekend in Stockholm. This interview was a few weeks old, but now it is very recent for this Urban Burn event, which is a very interesting event where I think they'll be using some Bitcoin there too. Anyway, I brought this BTM to Stockholm in collaboration with Daniel Capiello from CopenCoin in Denmark. And the interesting thing about BTMs is what are they for? What's the point of them today?
I think that the best explanation is that regular people, the man on the street, can get access to Bitcoin by just, you know, exchanging fiat money for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Because today, if you want to buy Bitcoin, you would have basically scanning your passport, all your identification. Everything has to be sent to an exchange, and then they approve it, and you open an account. And then you can start trading, and you have to do bank transfers. So it's quite a complicated process. And
slow.
Yeah, it's slow. Also, it takes a couple of days before the money shows up in your account, and then you can trade it. And so it is a very complicated process and slow process. But it's also a good process if you want lots of Bitcoin, right? If you if you take $10,000.
Yeah,
that's an easy way.
But they have some limits on how much you can exchange per day over there. And let's say I want to use Bitcoin to buy something, I can use my Xapo card, which is connected to my Bitcoin account at Xapo, which is a custodian, of course. So I don't really have control over the Bitcoin they have, but I can use it. So as long as I can get approved by Xapo or Coinbase, they also have a card like that, you know?
Yeah. And so I think it's perfectly viable to have services that lets you have a reserve in Bitcoin, and then you use that reserve to buy things with. So there are both pros and cons with that approach. You have to bear in mind that Bitcoin is quite volatile in terms. I mean, but it's volatile in both directions. So,
But the BTM is for people who want to exchange fiat. I mean, paper bills into Bitcoin.
Exactly.
And
we're talking
about a type of cash, which is, you know, the paper bills are a type of cash, and Bitcoin is also a type of cash.
It's correct
in a way.
Yeah, so the definition of cash is interesting. So yep. My definition of cash is not about whether it's paper or electronic. My definition of cash is if there is capital controls on it.
Okay.
If there's no capital control, nobody can stop you from using it.
Yeah.
Then it is cash, right? And Bitcoin is even better cash than paper cash because the central bank could go out tomorrow and say that all the $100 bills are going to be invalid, are not going to be allowed to be used tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
That can never happen with Bitcoin unless the entire blockchain collapses. But as long as the network is upheld by all these participants, miners and buyers and sellers and everything, nobody can stop it. My account, the number of Bitcoins I have on my account will stay there forever until I use them.
They can only stop it while turning off the internet. I mean,
well, even if they turn off the internet, the blockchain is still stored on a hard drive.
Yeah,
once internet comes back online,
you can use it. Yeah.
You can use it again.
Yes, so you can still store your value until they turn it on again.
Yeah, exactly.
So we think Bitcoin is a better cash, type of cash. But this is a problem for all the people. I mean, they're talking a lot about taking away the cash from society at large. In Sweden, for instance. The goal of some politicians and, of course, of the banks is to get rid of the cash.
Yeah, so there are two explanations to that, I think, right? The first one is that those people who use cash today, they're essentially old people who are uncomfortable with technology. It's too complicated to use a cell phone with bank accounts and stuff like that. So they want paper cash because that's what they're grown up with and they know how to use it. But as you know, the number of places, especially in Sweden, that accept cash are reduced because you can actually say at the front door of a shop and say we do not accept cash
here. Yeah, and I've seen that lately more and more at cafes. There's a sign when you buy the coffee that says we don't take cash, but it's like they think that's a positive message. This is a cash-free place.
Yes.
And I'm like, what's good about that?
Yeah, and it's kind of unfortunate that old people are not comfortable with using technology. And there are some people who can't even have bank accounts.
Exactly. I mean,
you have refugees and other people. Like, yeah. There are people who live without identification in this country. I mean, for whatever reason, right?
There are people who have big debts and they can't get a bank account or a credit card today.
So I think there is a problem. I think that I'm totally supportive of the movement of trying to ensure that cash is a legal obligation to accept.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be able to refuse cash.
I agree
at
with
all.
That. Yeah, I think so too.
Because I think it's kind of unfortunate that there are groups of people who will not be able to participate in the economic society. So if
Bitcoin, but then it sets the stage for Bitcoin to take over.
Yeah. Well. That doesn't solve the problem with the old people, right? They are not comfortable with Bitcoin either. but the good thing about Bitcoin is that if you're a refugee, like in Syria, for instance, and let's say that Bitcoin is way more accepted than it is today, right?
Yeah.
He could basically take all his wealth and store it in his brain if you use a brain wallet.
Yeah.
So if you have a really good password, you have to be very careful about picking your password, but imagine that you do that. You can store it in your brain and then you flee the country, and when you show up here, you can basically safely go take some electronic wallet, but you still have access to your wealth and you don't have a bank account. You can still participate in the economic society. You can buy things, you can buy food, or you can do the things that you are able to do with normal economic activity. So in that sense, Bitcoin is very nice in terms of those properties because it's very similar to cash. You don't have to have an account, a custodial, a bank, or you don't have to trust anyone. It is, and Bitcoin is even safer than cash because if you store it in your brain, the brain wallet, the only way a thief can steal your money is basically by kidnapping you or, you know, threatening you to
death. Even then you can give him the fake brain wallet password when you have just a small amount of Bitcoin stored.
Exactly. So you can never know for sure that you have the real Bitcoin, right? So it's a great way of defining cash in the new society, I would say.
But even if cash would be removed from the Swedish society or, let's say, from the EU, the US dollar will still be around for a long time to come, I'd say, because it's everywhere in the world. It's a very difficult thing to take away the US dollar. So that kind of cash will still be there. So the BTMs will still be there for a long time, even if we take away cash. Because you can see, if you want to use sort of the gray market or black market areas, you need to use the US dollar in the future then.
Well, there will always be cash in some form, I expect, because people... But I think people
will even invent new types of cash if the government takes away their cash.
Well, what I think...
They do it already in Bitcoin.
So there are two things, right? Cash is convenient because of these paper bills and coins. And the property you need to have on cash is that it should be very difficult to forge it, right?
Yeah.
And today we have governments who are very careful in producing these notes to make sure that they cannot be forged, right? That's the main property, right, of the cash bills.
Mm.
But then it's very easy to exchange. You just hand it over to someone,
mm-hmm.
and so. But there is another reason why governments want to get away with cash, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So there are two reasons. The first reason is that what you normally say the official reason is that The economic society functions much faster. It becomes more liquid because you don't have to think about the paper bills and to
they,
secure them.
They talk about
them.
The terrorist stuff too, yeah.
No, well, but
traceable money.
Yeah, that's perhaps one aspect of it. But yeah. I think that the more normal economic aspect is that cash is a very slow and unsecure way of transferring wealth between accounts and between people. So yeah. You want to so that's the typical message that you send is that we need to get go away with cash because then you don't have to use your vehicles to transport a lot of cash from one place to another to the bank etc. There's
yeah.
a lot of
which is a good thing yeah,
and
yeah.
there's a lot of energy being spent on transferring these cash
yeah,
back and forth.
Replacing the yeah. bills every 5 years or so.
But then there's this conspiracy theory as well, right? That banks want to central banks or governments wants to get rid of cash because the official message is usually to stop money laundering and terrorists. But I think also, and this is the conspiracy theory, that they want if you get rid of cash, you can introduce negative interest rates.
Yeah, yeah.
Because then there's no way a citizens can extract the money from the bank to avoid the negative interest rate, yeah, which is yeah, what yeah. you normally do, right? Yeah. Today, banks get negative interest rates on their account on the central bank, in at least in Sweden, right? Mm. And in Switzerland and in some other countries, in yeah. Denmark as well. But they don't want to pass on this cost to the account holders because they're afraid that the account holders will withdraw their money into paper form. And then they can avoid the negative interest if the bank pushes the negative interest on their customers,
yeah.
which then becomes a problem because then if people start withdrawing their money from the bank, what happens is that the bank becomes a zombie bank. There's no money being transported in that bank. Yeah. No, there's no economic activity. But their debt to the central bank, the regular bank's debt to the central bank, increases in the same amount as people withdraw their money from the bank. So it's just a reshuffling of debt if you do that. But the bank has a requirement in law, or actually it's not a law, but the central bank specifies how much reserves the bank must have yeah. at the central bank. Mm-hmm. And if you go below that line, the limit, then the bank becomes insolvent.
Yeah, but then they can just increase the limit for all of them, right?
They reduce the limit for all of them. And that happens in China, for instance, a couple of times. They usually always reduce the limit when yeah. there is a problem. And yes, the Swedish central bank can do that too. But when you do that, when you reduce the limit, you put the bank on risk because a bank needs to make payments to their customers every day. Right, they have and they use their liquidity on the central bank account to settle these payments,
yeah.
and the bank must never ever default on those payments. That's why they need to have a reserve on the central bank,
yeah.
and that's why the central bank tries to put a limit. And if they go below that limit, they have to lend from the central bank. And yeah. how they lend from the central bank, they use bonds yeah. that they deposit at the central bank. And in return, they get money, and that's called a repo. Repurchase agreement is the...
But why are they hoarding cash in some German banks now, then?
Well, the interesting aspect is that the negative interest... The central bank is trying to increase the economic activity in the country, for every country where the central bank exists. And they do so by trying to punish banks having money at the central bank. And they think that by punishing them, having a negative interest rate means that there's an associated cost of storing your money at the central yeah, yeah. bank, which means that they think that the idea here is that that will let the banks lend their reserves or the extra money they have at the central bank to the people or to the economy, which means that we get more economic activity. That's the theory. That's the Keynesian theory at large to do that. But that doesn't work.
No, it's a confused system, all
yeah,
of this.
Yeah,
it's a very, very, very complicated
system. It's a very, very complicated system, and I, I'm I will spend some time talking about that in my blog. In a couple of weeks, I will try. I'm trying to digest all the thoughts in my head to write something about this. This is a very complicated subject.
If we want to compare it to Bitcoin, let's do that. Or do you want?
Could we just finish the one with the where you say that the Swiss banks are hoarding cash, there are more banks trying to do that. Yeah. So that's a way of banks. They basically take out the money in terms of paper bills and store them in a vault.
Yeah, which is funny.
And that's actually what banks used to do.
Long time ago.
Before computers existed, that's exactly what they did, right? They had cash and
some
in the
gold,
vault.
Maybe.
And yeah,
some
gold.
Silver, yeah.
But they need to have cash because they need to settle payments every day, right? And people would probably only accept cash. They wouldn't accept gold because prices are set in the currency of the country.
Yeah.
So, but there's a nice way of avoiding the central bank negative interest rate by basically pulling out all your money in cash and store it in the vault. It's legal to do so for banks.
Yeah.
And some banks are starting to do that. But of course, the number of paper bills run out because we don't have that much paper bills in the country, right?
Well, if the purpose of all these strange actions the banks and the central banks are doing is to uphold the value of the currency for everybody involved, more or less.
It's different for different countries. In Europe, the ECB is doing this because they want to, according to the economic models, the Keynesian theory, is that more money brings more economic activity. And because the economic activity is stagnating in Europe, they are just pumping more and more money and hoping that things are going to pick up.
They try to increase the velocity of money here.
But it doesn't happen, right? Banks are just taking that money and keep them at the central bank, or they buy stocks or even gold with them. So the money doesn't get its way through the economy anyway.
They should have learned that from the financial crisis in the States. When they gave all this QE money to the banks, that did not increase the velocity of money in the way they intended it to do. It's a delayed effect.
Yes.
And
the other scaring part here is that when banks print more money, which is basically what QE is, that's the layman term of QE, is that the bank prints money, is that the banks gets the printed money. Right, and then they are supposed to lend it out, but they don't. So they buy stocks with it or invest it in stocks or whatever, so it means that the rich people get richer when the central banks injects more money in the society, and we have seen that since the 1970s, that the difference between the different incomes groups are diverging, and the top 1% is accelerating. They are getting more and more wealth.
Yeah, and that's probably the reason why we have Bitcoin here now. I'd guess that's why Satoshi did Bitcoin.
Satoshi did Bitcoin because he was extremely mad at the governments were bailing out the banks. Exactly. So once the banks they invested their money unwisely, and they were basically going under. And instead of punishing the banks, the government was so afraid, so they will say, "Okay, we're going to bail out the banks," and it's that's a very technical, easy thing to do because you put some new numbers in the computer system, and all is good. if you think really hard about it, what happens is that it's the taxpayers that gets punished for rescuing the banks. And there has never been an example where bailing out the banks has been profitable for the people, not even in Sweden, right? No. People tend to say that in Sweden, wow, it was a great success story. We were bailing out the banks in the early 90s and everything was good and now the people has got back their money. No. Mm. If you do the calculation, the taxpayers have lost.
Yeah.
And so therefore they're changing the rules now, right? They're changing the rules so that this should never happen again. So Sweden were fighting in the Europe EU to try to pursue to push for their model because they were saying they were so successful, but it wasn't, right? So they got overruled. So the new rules from the EU is that there's going to be a bail-in, right? Which means that there it's the shareholders of the bank, and the ultimately it will be the account holders at the bank that will get punished first.
Like in Cyprus.
So that's going to be the new model. And the reason for this model is that the taxpayers of the country should never be the ones who pay for a specific bank going under. Now, this is very bad for Sweden because we only have four big banks that owns the entire market. Every bank of these four banks is systemic, which means that we basically...
Too big to fail,
Yeah, too big to fail. So we have no choice, basically. So in Sweden, there would be no difference, essentially, because the consequence of saying that a fourth of all the citizens in the country lose their money or some of their money at the bank is going to be a complete disaster. Because people will lose faith in the banks and they will try to find some other ways of storing their wealth.
Bitcoin.
And yes, Bitcoin could be one of the options if that happens.
But if we just compare how Bitcoin gets its value to how fiat or all these actors in fiat are trying to uphold the value of their currencies. So, because this is an interesting subject too, how does Bitcoin work compared to fiat? We've talked a lot about Bitcoin in these episodes.
Yes. We've done,
but we haven't talked about actually the mining part of Bitcoin. For instance, I define Bitcoin as an information network backed by energy divided by time. Because you put a lot of energy into it, and you have this sort of guesswork algorithm which on average measures that energy and gets an output in form of these blocks of transactions, on average every 10 minutes. So
what happens today is that each block is the transactions that the people on this network want to transact, right? That's one part of it. But the first transaction in that block goes to the miner.
Yeah, the Coinbase reward.
That's called the Coinbase reward. And that is currently 25 Bitcoins. And it's going to very soon, I think in a couple of months, going to be reduced now.
Like in June or July, yeah.
June or July to 12 and a half. And every fourth year, it's going to halve again, right?
Yep.
So which means that you would think that why is it that way? I mean, that sounds crazy,
why is that good?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So the reason for that, what happens is that because new Bitcoins gets into circulation every 10 minutes and the new ones are the Coinbase, and if you count them up, today's 25 Bitcoins per 10 minutes, and you count them up per day, it's going to be 3,600 Bitcoins per day, right?
Yeah, that's going on average.
Mm-hmm. And that's going to be halved to 1,800 in a couple of months. So what is the total base supply of Bitcoins today? It's like 13 million or something,
13
right?
to 14 something. Yeah.
So if you calculate this very carefully, how many coins do you get per year, right? 3,600 times 365, then you can calculate the inflation rate of Bitcoin, right? And that's going to be reduced, and it's very high now, but it's going to be reduced now to around 4%, I think, in July, right? Mm-hmm. So when the inflation rate goes down, it means that less coins are getting into circulation, less new coins are getting into circulation, which means that the price of Bitcoin is going up. It has to go up.
Should go up.
It should go up.
To be able to pay for the energy used to produce them.
Well,
that's the mining part.
Well, that's one aspect. Yeah. But ignore the mining part. If the demand is constant, then the price must go up.
Yeah, because there'll be less Bitcoins.
If demand goes down, then the price will go down. Right?
But the miners have to sell their Bitcoin, so that's why they're important part of,
exactly.
of the equation here.
But what happens is that the reward will get halved, right? So it means that unless the demand goes up, making Bitcoin more valuable, which should go up because there are less Bitcoin in circulation.
Yeah.
But if that doesn't happen, right, then miners will take a hit, which is going to be enormous. And some miners will go under because they will go bankrupt.
Yeah.
Because, as you say, it costs them a lot of money to participate in this competitive business. And some miners go under, and the difficulty adjusts, and things move on, right?
There's no problems for users.
There's no problem for Bitcoin per se. It will always take care of itself.
From the point of view of Bitcoin, it doesn't care who mines it, just that somebody mines it.
Well, it doesn't even matter how many mines it.
No.
There's
as long as it's a lot more than the next most powerful coin out there.
So the competitive market of Bitcoin will make sure that it's secure enough to be used, right?
Exactly.
So it's a very self-regulating system.
That's what it is.
And
self-regulating.
And it's very self-regulating.
And that's why it's so interesting to read Reddit these days or to read mainstream media, because they don't at all seem to see this part of Bitcoin, that it is self-regulating. I mean, like the big businesses, the big VC capitalized companies, where they're sort of trying to, for instance, increase the block size to be able to have more of their own kind of transactions for a very low fee or for free. I'd say that Bitcoin is misunderstood, that it's not really produced. It's not made for those kind of businesses. Let's say an exchange. We have need to have a high frequency transaction sort of speed. They already have solutions for that. They don't need Bitcoin. I mean, Bitcoin is growing because there are people who need Bitcoin. Bitcoin are for the kind of transactions that somebody else says you can't do.
Yeah.
More or less.
Today, Bitcoin is mostly, I think there's a lot of illicit activity that what Bitcoin is used for.
Probably.
But it's also used for a lot of legitimate businesses as well,
yes,
right?
And
remember that in the US,
it's the same with the dollar.
Yeah.
I mean, banks are the biggest launderers of drug money today.
Yeah,
so.
I was just about to get to drugs in the US, I mean, cannabis is
It's legal in
certain states,
yes,
and because of this federal bank policy, the businesses that deal with cannabis, they're not allowed to open bank accounts.
Yeah, so they use cash now.
So they use cash, and cash is, you know, there's a lot of theft going on.
A lot of risks.
Holding cash. So Bitcoin is much safer. So people are using Bitcoin for that, and that's a legitimate business in that particular state, right?
Yeah.
So I think Andreas Antopoulos said something funny. He said that if you can't buy drugs with money, then it ain't money.
Yeah. That's pretty funny, actually.
Yeah. So,
but these last few months, we've seen a lot of hubbub online about sort of the block size. And I checked the mempool every day. I checked it today.
Yeah.
There is really no problem with the mempool. If you use a real Bitcoin wallet to transact, a native wallet connecting to the network, if you don't use Xapo or Coinbase or another custodian, you have no problem sending a transaction today.
Well, the only problem that can happen is that if someone tries to spam the network, and because the blocks are, on average, was it 700K or something? It's approaching the 1 megabyte
limit. It's 72% right now, so it's like about
700K. So it means that if someone wants to spam the network, it's much easier now. And what happens is that causes pain for a couple of days or something, and then goes it back to normal again. But ultimately, I think there are two camps here of developers. There's called the classic and the core camp. The core camp says that Bitcoin will never ever be able to solve the, you know, buy your coffee with Bitcoin problem. It doesn't matter what block size you have. It will not be able to scale to that level if everybody wants to buy a cappuccino in the world.
Well, with the Lightning Network, it would, right?
No? Yeah, of course. But
regular Bitcoin
will never be able to handle that. Mm. So instead of trying to just raise the limit, let's you know build new technology on top of Bitcoin, such as Lightning Network and other systems. So Bitcoin is a kind of a reserve, gold reserve, and then you build other systems on top of it. Yeah. But you can do it in such a way that it's not a fractional reserve system. So Lightning Network is not a fractional reserve system. You can build systems on top of the Bitcoin blockchain and still have this 100% you know, reserve requirement. So it means that you can solve, you can actually buy a cup of coffee, but it's not directly on the Bitcoin blockchain, but it's on something else on top of, yeah, on the Bitcoin blockchain.
And then it closes later, settles on the
Bitcoin
blockchain later.
Much, yeah, rarely later, right? Mm-hmm. You basically say that you accumulate all the transactions. Let's say you because if you think about it, how the current system works today with the fiat money, what happens is that, well, you have these banks, right, where you have millions of transactions in each bank, but then the number of transactions between banks, you settle the, yeah, sum that you need to transact to other banks once a day, yeah, and that's one transaction. So something similar will happen to the Bitcoin network. You have these millions of copies of cappuccino will coalesce into one transaction, a million transactions will become one transaction on the Bitcoin network or something like that. But for sure, we're going to need to have bigger blocks,
yeah, yeah,
anyway, because, yeah, the settlement transactions are still going to be way, yeah, more than we, yeah, have
for
today.
The number of users need to increase anyway. So
yeah, yeah. So the classic, the core camp, developer camp, they say, okay, let's focus on building these next layers. And the block size, we don't worry about that much right now, right? The other camp is the opposite. They say that bad things will happen when we hit the limit. So let's raise the limit while we are working on the other stuff.
Yep.
Both share exactly the same vision, that they are both agree, Gavin Andreessen and the other the core people, they agree that raising the block size is probably just kicking the can down the road. We still need the other systems, yeah, eventually, right? Yeah. But I guess that Gavin says that, well, maybe the computers will be good enough in the far ahead future so that maybe you could do everything on the blockchain, yeah, if you have gigabit networks and Ethernet.
But Gavin wanted to increase the block size really rapidly first in his first suggestions, like a year ago.
Yeah, I think that Gavin doesn't want the block size at all, just make it unlimited, yeah, right?
Which would be very cool, I think.
Yeah, I think it could work, right? It's not impossible.
Because the big worry is about China and the Great Firewall. I mean,
well,
many people worry about that. But why worry about it? Bitcoin doesn't care if it's mined in China or not.
You know? Oh, of course. I don't care about where the Bitcoin is mined. I don't think the core team cares either, right?
No.
So this thing that, oh, China has all the power, is just that's just garbage talk to
and
me.
And all the tests that's been done for the last 2 years on how much or how big block the firewall could handle,
yeah,
it's been between 4 and 8 megabytes.
Yeah, sure. But
so
now
we're at 1 megabyte.
So if you have an unlimited block size, there are two bad things that can happen according to the core team, right? The one bad thing that happens is the number of orphans will increase. Mm. Orphans are blocks that are mined, but then later turns out that they're not being part of the main chain. So
yeah, because somebody else was
faster,
yeah, yeah,
and produced more blocks. And so the main branch is, yeah, is longer than the, you know, the small little branches on the tree.
Well, that's
right?
Part of the idea of Bitcoin. That's is the way it's supposed to work.
It's supposed to work like that. But if the number of orphan increases, it means that it's harder for people to know when you can trust that the transaction has gone through. You have to wait longer, right?
Yeah.
So that's one problem. The other problem is that is the fear of centralization, because if there requires more hard drives, more disk space to store the blockchain and, you know, and more bandwidth, it means that it's going to be just big companies that are going to deal with Bitcoin and these other people who just have nodes for fun at their home in their basements, they will decrease.
Yeah.
So the number of nodes in the system will decrease, and that then there's a fear
that won't be a problem either, I guess, because I mean Satoshi himself said that in the future most nodes would be server farms of specialists.
Yeah,
know?
and the core team will then disagree with that, because there are some members in the core team who thinks that everybody should be able to have a replica of the blockchain on their hard drive in their homes.
That's weird.
So that if something really bad happens, that all governments goes in and confiscates the servers of all these big companies in the world, the blockchain will still be here, right?
But it's very cheap to buy a hard drive, so everybody could if you want to really support
yeah,
the network,
and
just buy a hard drive.
And that's Gavin's statement, is that who cares? I mean, it's so cheap right now, so everybody can store the entire Bitcoin. But if you know, if you increase the block size, more transactions, maybe maybe you hit the limit where it's going to be economic unfeasible to buy for everybody to buy this equipment.
But all these things, these things are about mining and consensus.
Yeah.
And we're talking about self-regulation. So, okay, for now, we have something interesting happening in China. But this is just now. And Bitcoin is a very, very young currency. It's only been around 7 years. It's nothing compared to other currencies, right? Or like gold. So this is just the beginning. In the future, we'll have other kinds of problems. And not dealing with China. Maybe we'll have some other capacity problem or some other sort of barrier. So then, should we then change Bitcoin to adapt to that kind of problem in the future? Why not have this sort of unlimited, more or less unlimited block size, and let's just have the market work it out, you know?
Yeah, but you need consensus to get there, and you don't have that, right? The Chinese miners are very afraid that they will be outcompeted by the Western world, which has better broadband connections and better internet, so they can push out their blocks much faster than China can, right? But
they're obviously very successful in mining in China, so they shouldn't be.
Yeah, but that's because they have subsidized power, right? So,
yeah.
So
it's, and they're very close to the manufacturing.
So it means that they have access to free energy or cheaper energy than the West, but they don't have access to better broadband connections than the West. So, so it means that, but you can solve these problems.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can change the protocol so that you can, instead of sending the entire block, the new block that the miner has mined, to the network, you just send difference lists saying the differences between this and that. And if you do that, this is called the ILBT solution. It's a abbreviation to invertible Bloom lookup tables.
Yeah.
So there's a technical solution that could deal with these problems, and so in future that will not be a problem with orphans, and you know, doesn't matter if China or if it's, there's a bad broadband connection or whatever, that all these problems can be solved.
Are they even problems? Aren't they just a part of this natural sort of development of Bitcoin?
Yeah, and that development will continue, of course, regardless, right? But there are two different camps here, right? You have the camp that says that everything has to be perfect before we change the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the other camp who say, let's just change the rules and work about this problem.
Let's try it out. Sort of.
Well, they fear that if you hit the limit, bad things will happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
People can't trust the network if the transactions don't go through in the way they're supposed to. And I mean normal users, right? They can't. Normally you wait 10 minutes and you know it's going to be in the blockchain. But if things start go bad, that, you know, your transaction, you broadcast it, but no miner will pick it up because the network is, you know, too full.
No.
So you have to change your fee, and you know, all these things are complicated for standard users to understand.
Yeah, yeah.
So what happens is that you get a system that you can't trust, right? You don't know how much it will cost your transaction,
or
how fast it is. So there are many parameters, and so the other camp will say, "Well, we have to increase the block size now because not doing so is also a change of game, right?"
Mm-hmm.
So everybody is a change of game. The problem is that there are different pros and cons with both type of approaches, and I am kind of neutral to this whole debate. I think that, well, let the market sort it out.
Yeah, me too.
Eventually, either one camp will win, right?
Yeah.
And today it looks like the core camp has the strongest support among miners and other people. They don't have support by businesses such as Coinbase and other businesses. And you know, the system is split a little bit. But I'm not worried long term, because there will be solutions to this problem. And yes, there might be some, you know, there might be a period where we have some pain, and we'll, let's see how painful that pain is.
Yeah,
right?
Anyway, we won't lose our Bitcoin.
No, definitely not. It's just about the trust of the network, right?
Mm-hmm.
And businesses, venture capitalists, have pumped a lot of money into this space. They want to have a network that they can trust in, and if some transactions don't go through, then they're afraid that people will abandon the system, and you know, the price goes down, and you know, it gets a the negative spiral effect until Bitcoin is gone, right? That's what some people fear. I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, there's so much money into the Bitcoin system. It has been successful for 7 years. Yeah. Something will happen to make sure that this network keeps running and running and running, right?
Yeah. So I'm very interested in the sort of the self-regulation part of the network. Yeah. And that has to do with the mining part and the consensus part mainly. And I'd like to talk about that, but to save that to the next episode, because this episode is about pretty long now. We have an interview in the middle too.
Yeah.
So it's let's sort of wrap it up. But and let's get back to the question of mining and consensus, because these big sort of VC capitalized companies, many of them are talking about the blockchain. I mean, IBM and etc. And they sort of don't want to touch the word mining or Bitcoin. And I think it's the other way around. I think the mining part is the most important part in Bitcoin and the most interesting part. And I think that it's the miners that really decide the future of Bitcoin, on how the miners act and how the miners decide. That's how the future of Bitcoin is going to be. So I think it's very, very interesting and important to understand how miners do and how they think. So I want to talk more about that. I think more of the big VC companies will fail because they don't understand that part, because it's so sort of entrenched in their old thinking, the fiat paradigm, and sort of QE and the fractional reserve banking. They're thinking in that sort of line, and if they don't really even want to touch this mining part, you see what I mean?
Well, the mining,
because the mining is sort of the invention here,
but it's not that true, right? Because there are a lot of, you have 21 Inc. for instance, that's supported by venture capitalists, and I think that,
but they're not doing well, you know, and these companies like BitPay are not doing well.
BitPay is not a mining company.
No, but all these VC companies, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, they're not doing well. Even 21 are not doing pretty well, according to my sources.
Okay, all right. So
what I'm saying is, if you want to get into Bitcoin, you should do it the Bitcoin way, not the old VC way.
Yeah, but
the old American way.
Yeah, but I think that the only revenue stream you have, if you're a venture capitalist and you want to build a company, mining is actually a good thing, because that's a revenue stream. Yeah. You get direct revenue stream.
Exactly.
Normally, venture capitalists invest in something and then wait for 5 years, and then they hope they have a new product that will revolutionize the world, right?
Yeah.
But if you invest some in mining, mining is actually quite profitable. According to my sources, the margin from the cost of mining Bitcoin is way lower than the reward they get. For the successful ones.
Yeah.
And the successful one is way lower. So they get a huge profit margin.
Yeah. And that's part of self-regulation. That's part of self-regulation here.
So it means that they don't need that much money, right? They need a little bit to get the mining farm going, right?
But you need a lot of money to do the chips.
Yes, and you need a lot of brain power so that you can raise the standards.
Yeah.
Right,
but just to design one chip is like $10 to $20 million to design a chip.
Exactly, and once it's designed, you have to be so quick because the other ones are out there with their new chips as well.
Exactly.
So the head start you have to use it very, very quickly, right? And to get as much money. So mining is not a very nice business to be in. I think it's a very stressful business.
Yes,
I've been
into that business.
But it is the most profitable business of Bitcoin today.
Absolutely.
And I
the
think
best business.
And then the other businesses that you know, wallet providers, etc. You can always reduce staff. I mean, you can always cut costs, and that's what BitPay did, right?
Most of them, they build companies on some sort of idea of the future. They don't have a use case today. If you have a mining company, you have a use case today. You produce Bitcoins. It's a very simple business idea.
Yeah.
But BitPay, sometime in the future, everybody's going to use BitPay. We don't know about that at all.
No.
Exactly.
We will perhaps using Lightning Network.
Yeah.
Don't need... Well, BitPay is good because they transact between fiat and so the exchanges have a very interesting use case, right?
Like Coinbase.
And they try to bridge the gap between the fiat money world and the Bitcoin world, right? So
the temporary solution, because in the future we won't even need them.
if everything goes into Bitcoin in the entire world, we will not need any exchanges.
Exactly.
And we don't need anything, right? So that everybody will have their own Bitcoins and everything will be good.
But everything will be good.
the governments will not be too happy, though, because they will lose the power of their own money.
Yeah,
right?
It depends on who is in the government, you know?
That's true, because the people would have voted for governments that are pro-Bitcoin, so they will be happy too. Yeah. But okay, let's say the central banks will not be very happy.
Yeah, exactly.
They will disappear.
Be the big salaries will disappear from those people. Yeah. I've been inside this Riksbank, central bank in Sweden. Yeah. The building is really expensive. Everybody working in there have their really, really good-looking clothes. It's a very expensive place to run. Even their doors are like big silver vault, kind of very, very expensive to design doors. I mean, everything around a central bank and a national fiat currency is so expensive.
But Sweden has the oldest central bank in the world.
Wow, that's
amazing. So they probably have the greatest building when they were.
They do. Well, I want to return to the part of mining and consensus in the next episode and really delve into that part.
All right.
I think it's really interesting to understand how does this consensus work.
Right.
But thank you very much for this episode.
Oh, sure. No problem. Great being here.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.